welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. In this hour, drama. Later on, we'll hear the first broadcast of the Encore Theater from 1946, but right now, the final episode of the experimental show, the CBS Radio Workshop. After 18 months on the air, this was a show that was considered to be true radio art. The program's mission was exactly what their opening slogan implied, that it was dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. With offbeat but poignant human dramas, abstract comedies, and even broadcasts delivered completely in verse, the show was actually a welcome comeback from the forerunner of the series, the Columbia Workshop, from the 1940s. It was there that the proving ground lay for radio heavyweights, from actors to sound designers who were comfortable experimenting with sound, and radio plays that were not necessarily appealing to a mass market. On its maiden broadcast, author Aldous Huxley introduced the first of a two-part adaptation of his groundbreaking novel Brave New World, and with a cascade of innovative sound effects, the two shows made broadcast history by ultimately creating a fervor for something different on the air that fans of the original Columbia Workshop craved. And they weren't the only ones. Seasoned radio actors and guest directors clamored for a chance to be part of the workshop and paint their audible pictures on the show, or bat around ideas and make changes on the fly, as opposed to most other shows where cast and crew were beholden to one script and director and even a proper sponsor, which the workshop didn't have. Heard Friday evenings in its first year, the show we'll hear next was on the air on a Sunday afternoon at 4, and following suit, broadcasting a story past what radio listeners knew as tradition. It's the tale, Young Man Axelrod, from September 22, 1957.
From Hollywood, the CBS Radio Workshop. Dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind.
As freshmen first we paint to Yale, all drawn from the wall, excitement, patience made us pale. All drawn from the wall, Eli, 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 Yale, all drawn from the wall, Eli, 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 Yale, all drawn from the wall.
On college campuses, across the nation from Bowdoin in Maine to Occidental in California this Indian summer afternoon, the freshman class is anxiously settling down to the first of its bright college years. For them, we have a story. It is a tender legend of the Yale of yesteryear, Young Man Axelrod. Written by Sinclair Lewis, Yale class of 1907, and dramatized for the workshop and directed by William N. Robeson, class of 1928. Narrated by John Heusrath, class of 1926. And most particularly, dedicated to the Yale class of 1961. Young Man Axelrod.
Here's to good old Yale, drink it down, drink it down. Here's to good old Yale, drink it down, drink it down. Here's to good old Yale, see so hearty and so hail. Drink it down, drink it down, drink it down, down, down.
It was a September afternoon in one of the years between the two world wars. The great elms of the old campus wore the last of summer's greenery. The warm sun caressed the Gothic crag of Harkness and spread a golden sheen on the weathered bricks of Connecticut Hall, before which Nathan Hale, class of 1773, forever stands in bronze, despairing that he has but one life to give for his country. Into this timeless scene, through the entry between Osborne and Vanderbilt halls, strode an anachronistic figure, a rugged, white-bearded old man. Wearing a neatly pressed black broadcloth suit and celluloid collar, Knut Axelrod, retired Minnesota farmer, a man with a destination, the office of the Dean of Yale College.
Come in.
Excuse me, you are the dean of the college?
Yes.
I am Knut Axelrod.
Yes, Mr. Axelrod. What can I do for you?
I am here about entering college.
I see. And where is the young man?
The young man?
Yes. Your son, or perhaps your grandson?
Oh, no, sir. It's me. It is I.
You? Well, I must say, this is rather irregular.
No, sir, everything is regular. I pass all the examinations. It wasn't easy, but I pass.
Yes. Yes, yes, so I see. Yes, is your name Knut Axelbrod.
Yeah, that's me.
Everything seems to be in order. But, Mr. Axelbrod...
Yeah?
If you please pardon me for saying this, but you are not, well, not exactly the usual age of our beginning students.
Oh, yeah, I know, but,
What?
Well, there's a fella said once, youth is so wonderful, it is a shame it must be wasted on the very young.
But...
And I feel still young.
Oh, yes, yes, I'm sure you do. But I'm still curious.
About what, Dean?
Why Yale? Why do you want to come to Yale?
Well, how could I say that? All my life I work hard. I farm my land, I raise my family, I get up with the sun, I go to bed with the sun, and always I say, that is not enough. Always I say, Knut, you are a dummy. I say, what good is a man without education? And then when my last son is grown man, I quit. I give him the farm, and I say, Knut, now you can get education. So I read. All day long I read, sometimes half the night. I read almost all the books in the public library back home in New Orleans. Then one day, I read the book about Yale. And I say, by golly, I got to go there and learn some more.
What book did you read?
Stover at Yale.
Yes. But Mr. Axelbrod, you understand that Yale has changed a lot since that book was written.
Oh, Yale is Yale. I believe that.
Oh, so do I, sir. But Yale is for, well... What I mean to say is
What you mean to say is maybe Yale is for the learning of beauty?
Yes. Yes, I suppose that is what I meant to say.
And so Knut Axelbrod was duly registered as a freshman in Yale College and assigned a room, not in Berkeley Oval where the cream boys of the prep school cliques lolled in comparative luxury, but in a grubby frame building far down High Street where were lodged the unplaced freshmen, the scrub seniors and assorted grinds and self-help students. Here he met his roommate, Ray Gribble.
Come in, door's open.
Are you Mr. Gribble?
Yeah.
I am Mr. Axelbrod.
And whatever you're selling, I don't want any.
Oh, well, I'm not selling anything. I am your new roommate.
Your what?
Your roommate.
Who said so?
The fellow at the registrar's office. He said to come here, room 18, and he say my roommate will be Mr. Gribble.
Well, beggars can't be choosers.
Please?
Nothing. You can have that bed over in the corner. Got a couple of broken springs, I'm afraid. You know how it is. First come, first served.
Oh, sure, sure. Thank you, Mr. Griffin.
Wait, wait, freshman, wait. Wait for the songs like the sky.
Knut Axelbrod set out to savor the college he had learned from a book. He sat on the Yale fence in what he felt was an appropriate pose, not knowing that this was no longer done, not realizing why the undergraduates snickered as they passed. He went out to Yale Field to watch the football tryouts, but when he tried to get acquainted with the beefy candidates, they clearly indicated they thought he was crazy. Everywhere his warm overtures of friendship were met with the cruel, cold disinterest of youth. He was not a campus character. He was the class freak.
'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves.
Hey, Axelbrod, pipe down. I got a math assignment to finish.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gribble. You know, but this book, by golly, it is so funny.
What book?
Alice in Wonderland.
Is that your English assignment?
Oh, no.
Well, then why are you wasting your time on it?
It's funny, by golly.
I don't understand you, Axelbrod. I just don't understand you.
Why? I'm a simple fella.
Well, it strikes me a man of your years ought to be thinking about saving his soul instead of reading children's books.
Oh, I don't think Alice in Wonderland is very much for children. It says some pretty deep things in a funny way.
Rubbish.
And my soul's in pretty good hands. I go to chapel every morning.
It's compulsory. Axelbrod, what is your purpose in life? What do you hope to get out of Yale?
I can't say it very well, but there was a fella once maybe said it better. He said, Truth is beauty, and beauty, truth. That's all you know on Earth, and all you need to know.
You try to buy a meal with truth, and try paying the rent with beauty.
The same fella said, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness.
Yes, but remember Longfellow's exhortation. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate. Still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor.
Yeah, but another fella said, the world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our power.
Oh, you are a hopeless romantic, Axelrod, and I doubt if you will ever amount to a hill of beans.
Hi, Gribble.
Hi, Atchison.
Well, well, how's old man Axelrod tonight?
Good evening, Atchison.
I think our bearded wonder is in his second childhood. I just caught him reading Alice in Wonderland.
You'd do better to work on that English assignment for tomorrow. That Merchant of Venice. I can't make head nor tail out of Shakespeare.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth like a gentle rain from heaven. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives.
You know it by heart.
I learned it a long time ago.
Yeah, but do you know what it means?
Yeah, I think so.
That beats me.
Well, listen. What is that?
The whiffin' poofs over at Maury's.
Whiffin' poofs? What is whiffin' poofs?
A whiffin' poof is an undergraduate with a rich father and a so-called singing voice. He's got nothing to worry about. He can afford to hang around Maury's and drink beer and sing every night. His old man pays the bills. He doesn't have to work for his education the way fellows like Atchison and I do. But if it weren't for us, they'd never get through college. We wait tables for them, we tutor them.
I think it's not so bad to enjoy life when you're young. There is such a long, long time afterwards when there is nothing but work.
I say the time to learn proper work habits is when you're young.
Yeah, that's right, Gribble. These rich kids couldn't get to first base without their old man's money behind them. Take Washburn, for instance.
No, don't talk to me about Washburn.
Oh, what's the matter with Washburn? Is he a biffin' poof?
Not even that. He doesn't do anything. He's a disgrace to the class. He doesn't go out for anything.
Yeah, he claims he's a poet, but he doesn't even heal the lit.
He's a bloody snob.
He seems like a nice young fella.
How would you know? You ever talk to him?
No, but I seen him in class.
When? He cuts most of them.
Well, that's one consolation. He'll probably flunk out at midterm.
No, not him. He gets on the dean's list, his old man will throw the university another $1 million endowment. That's the way these bright boys get through.
You know what you fellas sound like?
What?
A bunch of hired hands talking behind the barn at harvest time.
What's that mean?
They don't own the farm. They don't like the farmer. And they can be replaced any time.
Look here, Axelrod. I don't think I like that remark.
Oh, be quiet, little boy. And listen to the whiffin' poofs.
Is earth wherever one walks upon it, be it Camelot or Minnesota or on the Yale campus, possibly even in the Harvard yard. The buildings ceased to be temples to Knut Axelrod. They became structures of brick and stone, many of them beautiful, some of them excessively ugly. The young men ceased to be young gods, but individuals, many of them pleasant hedonists, some of them excessively rude. Even the professors ceased to resemble latter-day Socrates.
And so, gentlemen, there was no doubt in the mind of Themistocles. He, and only he, was certain of the meaning of the oracle's words, your safety lies in wooden walls.
Well, then what she say?
What could she say, considering the circumstances?
Such was the background for one of the great...
The professor is talking. Don't pipe down, Whiskers.
Maybe I pipe you down sometimes.
Anytime, Pop, anytime.
That is all. Good day, gentlemen.
Say, Professor.
Yes, Axelrod.
I'd like to speak to you 1 minute.
Yes, what is it?
You're a fine fellow, Professor. I'd like to hear what you say.
Well, thank you.
And I'm pretty strong fellow, and I'd do something for you.
What are you driving at?
But these fellas in the class, they don't pay attention. You just call on me. I spanked the son of a guns for you.
Thanks so much, Axelrod, but I don't fancy that will be necessary. After all, they're not schoolboys. They're young gentlemen.
Well, then why don't they act like it?
Speaking of behavior, Axelrod, there's something I've been wanting to mention to you.
Oh, yes, Professor.
I do wish you wouldn't show off so much when I call upon you during quizzes.
Show off?
Yes. You answer at such needless length, and you smile as though you find something highly amusing about me.
Oh, no, Professor. Well, I don't know I smile. If I do, I guess it's just because I am so glad when my stupid old head gets the lesson good.
Yes, well, that must be very gratifying, I'm sure. But in the future, let's be more careful, shall we? Hmm?
Yes, sir.
Good day, Axelbrod.
Down from the Harkness Tower floated the chimes of noon, unheeded by the busy undergraduates piling out of classes, criss-crossing the campus as they dashed for eating clubs and fraternity houses, but not unheeded by the old man with bowed head and no place to go and no one to go with. Going home, the chimes sang to Clute Axelbrod. Going home. And before his misty eyes, the flaring red and orange of the autumn trees and the yellowing ivy-covered walls seemed to give way to the rolling gray stubble of his Minnesota farm. He had to get away from the campus, from the students. He had to get away by himself somewhere, anywhere where he would not be reminded how alone he was. He walked slowly out Whitney Avenue toward the butte-like hill of East Rock. And there, sitting atop the rock, at last he found a friend.
That's quite a view, isn't it, Axelbrod?
Hmm?
Oh, I'm sorry I startled you.
Oh, no, that's all right. You're Washburn, aren't you?
That's right. I don't think we ever met officially, but I know who you were, of course.
Yeah, I guess everybody knows who I am.
Mind if I share the bench with you?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. You cutting classes, too?
Yeah. Today, I cut classes.
You know, Axelbrod, I'm glad to have run into you.
You are? Why?
Well, I've been thinking quite a lot about you lately, and it seems to me we have a lot in common.
You and me?
Mm-hmm. We're the class scoundrels, you know. We came here to dream. Here, these busy little goats like Atchison and Giblets, or whatever your roommate's name is, think we're fools not to buck for grades.
I guess you're right. They are so serious about everything. Grades, the football team, burning their way. They never laugh. So sometimes I think they are older than me.
Exactly.
Hey, that is a pretty book you have there.
Oh, this is the poems of Alfred de Musset. You like to look at it?
Yeah. I never see such a book. Leather is so soft. Printing is in gold. It's a foreign book. I can't read that. But, you know, that is the kind of book I always wanted to hold in my hands.
Would you like to hear a little of it?
Yeah, please.
Ce livre est toute ma jeunesse. Je l'ai fait sans presque y songer. Il y paraît, je le confesse, et j'aurais pu le corriger.
Bye. Golly, that is pretty.
Well, it means...
No, I don't care what it means. It is like music. Like music I never heard before.
Music? Well, say, that reminds me. Schoenstein is playing Lalo tonight.
Oh, I thought the game was tomorrow.
Oh, no. Schoenstein is a violinist. Lalo is a composer. I've got a couple of tickets now. Maybe you'd like to go with me.
Oh, sure. I like to hear a fella play fiddle. You know, we got the fella back home, Uri Hansen. He can play Turkey in the Straw faster than anyone in Cottonwood County.
Oh, Schoenstein isn't exactly that kind of fiddler, but I think you might enjoy him.
Sure I will, by golly.
Fiddling such as Canute had never dreamed of. This was more than music to the old man. It was beauty beyond bearing. The rapier flashes of the violin tore jagged wounds in his soul, and in the next phrase, soothed them, bound them, and healed them with the heavenly unguent of melody. Canute did not listen. He felt the music, submerged himself in it, and sank slowly into its all-enveloping arms.
Long after the last note died away, the music played on in Knut's memory as he sat in the room of his new friend having a midnight snack.
There we are. Tea's brewed nicely. Sugar?
Lemon? Afraid I had no cream.
Just tea, please.
Right. Do try some of this pâté de foie gras.
What's that?
You try it. You'll like it.
Thank you. What do you call it?
Pâté de foie gras.
That tastes like the liver sausage we got back home.
Well, yes, I suppose it does. Well, that's what it is, really. It's goose liver.
Oh, then why don't they call it goose liver?
Well, you see, that's the French name.
Aha. You been to France?
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, I spent all last year in Paris.
You did?
Yes.
But what is it like?
Paris? Well, its women are the most beautiful in the world. Its men the wisest. Its food the finest. Its boulevards the grandest, and its monuments the most, well, monumental. Paris is beauty.
Well, maybe it's a good thing I never go there.
Why?
Well, that's the way I thought about Yale before I come here.
Well, yes, I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. Maybe you see different things when you are an old man.
Oh, come on now. Now, you're not an old man.
That's what they call me. Old man Axelbrod.
Oh, nonsense to me. You're a young man, Axelbrod.
I am.
Why, certainly. People like you and I don't grow old.
The talk went on and on. Good talk of books and philosophy and beauty. The talk Knut Axelbrod had thirsted for all his life. But at last the fire had burned to ashes, the candles were guttering, and the window was a gray rectangle of twilight dawn.
Look! By golly, it's daylight.
Oh, so it is.
Well, I go to bed now, I think.
Well, I suppose that's about all that's left to do, huh?
I don't have the right words, maybe, but I want to say thanks.
Thanks for what?
For this night. I think this night is what I came to college for, this one night.
Well, we must do it again sometime, real soon.
Yeah, we do that.
Well, Well, look here, Newt, take this, will you?
Oh, the pretty little poetry book?
Yes.
But,
No, I want you to have it. Please.
Thank you, kid. Thank you.
But life cannot be only good talk before a crackling fire. Dawn comes cold, dawn comes gray, dawn brings reality. As Knut Axelbrod walked across the morning empty campus, he knew what he must do.
Age and youth. They just don't mix. This beautiful place belongs to the young men, not to me. And that boy, well, if I saw him again, it would not be the same. I tell him all I got to say tonight. Next time I wouldn't be young man Axelbrod. I'd just be an old boar. I live 65 years for tonight. It was worth it.
That afternoon, in the day coach of a westbound train, an old man sat smiling, a look of great content in his eyes, and in his hand a small book in French, though the curious fact is that this old man couldn't read one single word of French.
Listen to the CBS Radio Workshop production of Young Man Axelbrod by Sinclair Lewis, adapted for radio and directed and produced by William N. Robeson. John Hoyt was the narrator. Carl Swenson played young man Axelrod, and others in the cast included John Daner, Dick Crenna, Jackie Kelk, Ben Wright, and Frank McDonald. The chorus was under the direction of Amerigo Marino. This is the CBS Radio Network.
The CBS Radio Workshop, on Tuned to Yesterday, their final broadcast from September 22, 1957. You're listening to an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. Now time for the Encore Theater, their first of not too many broadcasts during radio's yesteryear, the story called Magnificent Obsession, heard on CBS on June 4, 1946.
And now the Encore Theater presents Magnificent Obsession, starring Cornell Wilde as Dr. Robert Merrick, and Loreen Tuttle as Helen Hudson.
To me, Dr. Wayne Hudson had always been a legend, even back in those days when my life was dedicated to pleasure and very little else. He was one of the world's great surgeons and one of the world's great men. We never met, and yet his life ended because of me, and my life began because of him. That was many years ago, but I can still recall that dark morning when I came to in Dr. Hudson's Brightwood Hospital with a splitting headache and no idea at all what I was doing there. I heard voices outside my door, and I lay there in a cold sweat, listening.
How did it happen, Dr. Ramsey?
Dr. Hudson had gone for a swim to freshen up. He was very tired. His heart was overtaxed. We could have saved him with a pulmotor, but it wasn't there.
Well, where was it?
On the far side of the lake. Young Bobby Merrick and some of his friends had staged an all-night poker party. Early this morning, Merrick decided to take them all for a sail on his boat. He was knocked out and overboard by a swinging boom. They rushed over in a speedboat for the pulmotor, and Justin took it to them. If we had had it, we could have saved Dr. Hudson.
We could have saved Dr. Hudson. We could have saved Dr. Hudson. I lay there for days with those words lashing at me. I saw them in the eyes of the people who came to see me. I saw them in the eyes of the nurses and the doctors. And I began to think, I'll never escape them. Every time I read a death notice, I think, could Dr. Hudson have saved that life? And at last, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I cornered Nancy Ashford, the head nurse. Look, Mrs. Ashford, I'd like to ask you something, and I'd like to have you ask yourself the same question. Is it my fault that my life was saved and young Dr. Hudson was drowned?
How did you know? Nurses are always under strict orders not to tell.
No, the nurses didn't tell me, but I have ears and I have eyes, unfortunately. You're all asking yourself, what right have I to be alive and Dr. Hudson dead?
No.
Well, I'm asking myself that. I know my life isn't worth his.
Dr. Hudson wouldn't want you to feel that way.
No. Well, how would Dr. Hudson want me to feel?
I think Dr. Hudson would say that if you felt responsible for the loss of a man, then you'd better find a way to make up for that loss.
Well, that's a pretty big order, sister.
Yes, Mr. Merrick. That is a pretty big order.
After I left the hospital, I spent the days and the nights walking and thinking. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't sleep. I was confused and lost, and growing more and more convinced that Bobby Merrick was a pretty miserable character, and the world would be much better off without him. And then one day, when I was out walking, I met a girl. Her car had broken down.
Hello there. I wonder if you could help me.
She smiled at me, and for a moment, the fires burning inside me flickered out, and I was almost at peace. I've always laughed at people who talked about love at first sight, but her smile went straight to my heart and stayed there. I took all the time I could fixing her car, and I was sorry when I had finished.
Thank you so much. I'm very grateful to you.
Oh, it was nothing at all. I was glad to help a lady in distress.
I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't come along.
I don't suppose that there would be a chance of seeing you again. I don't suppose I could call just to see how the car was getting along. Never mind, that probably sounded pretty fresh.
You're lonesome, aren't you?
Well, loneliness is only part of what's wrong with me, lady. Only a very small part.
You know, my husband used to say... Did you know Dr. Hudson by any chance? So many people did.
I beg your pardon. What did you say?
I just asked you if you knew my husband, Dr. Wayne Hudson.
No, I never had that pleasure.
Well, anyhow, he used to say that all pain passes and that we grow by it. Well, I'm not going to preach a sermon. Can I give you a lift?
No, thank you, Mrs. Hudson. Good night.
Wait a minute. Aren't you going to tell me your name?
Sure, why not? The name's Merrick, Mrs. Hudson. Bobby Merrick.
Bobby Merrick?
Yes, it's a pity, isn't it? For a moment, we were almost friends. Or am I presuming?
You are presuming. Good night, Mr. Merrick.
Stood there watching her car disappear over the hill, feeling as though I had been slammed against the earth until every nerve was bleeding. And then once more I started walking. Hour after hour, mile after mile, I didn't know where I was walking. I didn't care. I lost all consciousness of my surroundings until suddenly I realized that it was very late at night and I was cold and lost in more ways than one. I stopped at a house whose lighted windows suddenly appeared like a beacon.
Yes?
I beg your pardon, but I'm afraid I've lost my way.
Come in.
Thank you. If I could just use your telephone.
You look all in. Why don't you sit down and rest a few moments?
Thanks. I'm sorry to bust in like this. I thought I knew my way perfectly well. Hey, wait. Where have I seen that face before?
Oh, that's a bust of Dr. Hudson I made just before his death. It's for the hospital. You may have heard of him.
Heard of him? Oh, yes, I've heard of him. He's haunting me. First, my life is saved with someone's lung machine. Whose? Dr. Hudson's. Then they take me to a hospital. Whose? Dr. Hudson's. Then I meet a girl. A very beautiful girl. And whose wife is she?
Dr. Hudson's?
That's right. Then I come here to borrow a telephone. There he is again. He's haunting me. He's haunting me.
I see. You're old Mr. Merrick's grandson.
Yes, that's me. Bobby Merrick. A name that will go down in infamy. A name that will go down.
Now, you go right to sleep, Mr. Merrick, and in the morning we'll have a long talk. I've been wanting to talk to you for some time. Good morning, Mr. Merrick. Sleep well?
Oh, I beg your pardon. Would you mind telling me where I am?
You're in my house, on my couch, as a matter of fact. My name is Randolph. I'm a sculptor.
Oh, well, of course, that accounts for everything.
Here. Have some coffee while we talk.
Thanks. I hope I didn't cause you any trouble last night.
Not at all. When I learned you were a friend of Dr. Hudson's, I was glad to be of any service I could.
I'm sorry, but I can't claim any sort of friendship with Dr. Hudson.
Dr. Hudson was everyone's friend. I think you should know a little about him and a magnificent obsession of his. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be a sculptor. You see, Dr. Hudson taught me how to use my life, how to make contact with the source of infinite power.
The what?
The power that keeps the world and the stars spinning through infinite space. It applies to humans, too, and once you establish contact with that powerhouse, you can fulfill your destiny.
Well, I'm afraid this is all a little beyond me.
Well, there's no reason why it should be. Christ originated the science of generating human power, and so successfully did he practice it that he's more alive today than he was over 1,900 years ago.
Well, supposing there is such a power, how do you establish contact with it?
All you do is go out, find people who need help, and help them. Only it has to be done in absolute secrecy, and you must never let anyone know about it. Dr. Hudson lived by that doctrine. If you took it up, that would be one way of making up his loss. And there's another thing you might take up.
What's that?
His profession.
I've something to tell you, Mrs. Ashford.
Yes?
I'm going to study surgery.
You?
Yes. You told me Dr. Hudson would say I should make up the loss. Well, that's what I'm going to try to do. Maybe I won't succeed, but If I'm ever to have any respect for myself again, I have to try.
Nancy, would you like to... I'm sorry I disturbed you, Nancy. I'll stop by later.
Helen, Bob is going to study surgery.
Surgery? Bobby Merrick.
Yes, it does sound funny, doesn't it?
Have you any idea at all what it means to be a surgeon? It means years of study and work. It means discipline and self-denial.
It means much more than that, Mrs. Hudson. It means being able to look people in the eye again and to sleep at night. It means being able to look at some people and think, I have eased your pain. And at others and think, with God's help, I've given you years to live. It means being able to look at your hands and know that there's life in them and healing and that you're earning your place in this world.
Where did you learn all that?
From Dr. Hudson.
Yes. For a moment, you sounded like him.
She stood looking at me for a moment, and then she reached out her hand, and I took it. And once again, for that moment, we were friends. I asked if I could drive her home, and she said yes. And a lot of things seemed to be beginning, but they came to a quick end. It was my fault. She wanted to go straight home, but I was so happy to be with her that I went in the opposite direction. She was angry with me then. And when we came to a stoplight, before I could do anything, she jumped from the car. What happened then is still a confused, blurred thing. Helen, wait a moment. Helen! Well, Dr. Ramsey?
The operation was a success, at least as far as her life is concerned.
Thank God for that.
But there seems to be a depressed fracture involving the occipital lobe of the brain. I'm afraid she will never see again.
No. Oh, no. She will never see again. She will never see again. The words branded themselves into my brain. They were always there through the days that became weeks, the weeks that became months, months that gradually grouped themselves into years. I went on with my studies, always searching desperately for the thing that might restore Helen's sight. I'd try to watch over her from a distance.
Bob, as your lawyer, I must tell you that Helen Hudson's stocks aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
All right, replace her bad stocks and bonds with some of my good ones.
What?
She must have a steady income.
I heard from Dr. Richard this morning. Five of the specialists we wrote to have agreed to meet in Paris.
Good. Hey, what time is it?
Well, it's about 2. Why?
Oh, I've got to get to the park.
The park?
Yes, I go there every day at this time.
Well, this is certainly a switch on the old Merrick.
You bet it is. She came every day to the little park near her house, and I would sit there and watch her. She brought her Braille books with her, and she would sit there and study. It was a long time before I had an opportunity to speak to her, but at last one day, she dropped her book, and I was able to pick it up and hand it to her. Here's your book.
Oh, thank you. I didn't realize anyone was near. I was studying my lesson.
Would you let me coach?
Oh, I couldn't do that. I'd be embarrassed learning my ABCs with a grown-up.
It won't be long before you'll be reading Shakespeare. Did you know they have him in Braille now?
Yes, I did. But how do you know?
Well, I'm interested in the Braille system.
Oh? Are you a doctor?
A fledgling doctor.
Really? What did you say your name was, Doctor?
Robert.
Oh, Dr. Robert. I'm Mrs. Hudson, Doctor. Thank you so much for your courtesy. I must be going now.
Will you be here tomorrow?
Yes, I come here every day.
Well, I'll be waiting for you. Hello, Mrs. Hudson. You're late today.
Yes, I know. But so many exciting things have happened. You've been so good to me these past months. I want you to be the first to know. I'm going to Paris.
For a consultation?
Yes. A number of eye specialists are meeting there, and while they're having their convention, I suppose it's because of what my husband stood for in the medical profession, they've asked me to come.
Oh, I'm so happy for you. Surely men like Rochard, Donnelly, Rettenbacker will be able to find the answer.
How did you know they'll be there?
Well, they're the most famous. I just suppose they would be the ones. I'm sure they'll be able to help you.
Oh, I can't. I just can't tell you what it means to me. There's so many things I'm so hungry to see again.
You'll see them.
And I'll tell you something else. I'm very anxious to see you. All these months knowing you. Yes, I'm very anxious to see you.
I watched her go that day, knowing that if her sight was restored, I would never see her again. And I wished that somehow, some way, I had managed to say to her, I love you. If there's ever to be a woman for me, it can only be you. And suddenly I was very cold, and I walked away along a lonely street. Helen went to Paris for the consultation. I followed her there. I was in that consultation room, though Helen didn't know it.
Now, Mrs. Hudson, just fix your eyes as though you were looking straight in front of you. Now then, please tell me if you see a little light.
No.
The day before yesterday, she had definite perception of light.
You say you perceived light the other day, Mrs. Hudson.
I think so. Yes.
Which indicates slightly less trouble on one side of the brain than the other. Just rest for a few moments, Mrs. Hudson.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen?
Dr. Merrick, personally, I wouldn't operate.
And the rest of you, gentlemen?
Nine. It is no good for operation.
Every year we make new discoveries, Dr. Merrick. Perhaps next year or the following, we may be better able to help her. But right now, an operation is not the answer.
Dr. Robert.
Dr. Robert! Well, come in. What are you doing in Paris?
Oh, I had some business.
Oh, I may as well tell you right away. I'm not going to see again.
Oh, don't say that, Helen. You're going to see with my eyes. I've nothing else to do with the rest of my life but help you to see whatever you want to see. Come on now, I'll tell you what. Let's get all dressed up and go out and do the town. I'll show you Paris and show Paris you. Have some popcorn.
Thanks. Tell me some more about the carnival.
Well, on your right, madam, is Katinka, the fattest lady in the world. She tips the scales of 360 pounds, mesdames et messieurs. And on your left, we have a sword swallower.
Not real.
Yes, there it goes. The sword is disappearing right down his stomach.
Can you imagine doing that for a living twice a day?
One must eat.
Yes, but not swords. Hey, there's a Ferris wheel. Come on, let's go ride on the Ferris wheel.
Oh. Where are we now?
We're standing on top of a hill, and all Paris is at your feet. That music is coming from a little Italian inn down the hill away.
Oh, it's lovely, isn't it? Makes you think of moonlight and gondolas and stars and romance.
Will you marry me, Helen?
Oh, this combination of moonlight and music can be a very heady, dangerous thing, can't it?
Oh, don't. I've never been so serious about anything in my life.
I wish I could say yes. I wish I could say, here is my life. Take it and let me be all things to you. But I can't say that. I haven't even half a life to give you. You can't enter my world. And I've lost my passport to yours.
There's only one world.
I wish that were true, Bobby Merrick.
You know.
I knew the first time you spoke to me.
Why didn't you say something?
Why didn't I? Probably because somewhere along the line, and I couldn't tell you when or at what moment, I fell in love with you. And if that operation had been a success, I was going to find you and tell you that.
Darling, will you marry me? Will you please marry me?
It's getting late. We better start back.
Helen.
I'm very tired, please. Will you let me give you my answer in the morning?
If it's the right one, I will.
It will be the right one.
In the morning, there was a note for me at the hotel desk, and she was gone. She said, it doesn't matter particularly what she said. She didn't want to be a burden. Thank you for the days we've had together. Thank you for your love and your devotion. Words. A few dozen of them that rattled emptily against my heart. So then I had nothing but my work. And while it was exciting and gratifying, as time went on, I was more and more lonely for the happiness that had eluded me. It was a long time before I returned to America, before I returned to take over Dr. Hudson's position at Brightwood Hospital.
Dr. Merrick, this is a proud day for Brightwood Hospital. It's going to be a great pleasure working with you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas.
I tell you, it makes us feel pretty good to be a part of something that is constantly growing. Medicine and surgery have changed since I was your age, and they'll change more by the time you are mine. And always for the better.
Hello, Bobby. Welcome home.
Well, hello, Nancy, darling. You look wonderful.
I hate to tear you away from all these compliments, but there's a Mr. Randolph waiting. If you could just see him for a moment.
Oh, of course. I'll be glad to.
Right over here.
Mr. Randolph?
Hello, Bob. Don't you remember me?
Well, I'm afraid I...
You spent a night in my studio once.
Of course, the sculptor. How are you, sir? Please sit down. It's good to see you again.
You've come a long way.
I've got a long way to go.
You've become a great doctor at a very young age. And also, if I'm not mistaken, you've given with real generosity. Well, you did establish contact with a source of power, didn't you?
You're mistaken about one thing, Mr. Randolph. I didn't give anything to better myself in any way. I've founded clinics, I've donated to medical research, but it was for one person only who needed the kind of help that a doctor can give. Whatever I've been able to do was done in the hope that she might be one of those helped somewhere.
Dr. Merrick, let me tell you what I've come to you about. Not long ago, I was in Virginia, and while I was there, I happened on a very unfortunate case. A woman who is blind.
Blind?
This blind woman, whom I want you to help, affords us the opportunity to complete a circle. She is Mrs. Hudson.
Helen?
Yes. She's critically ill.
Helen! I'll go to her at once. She hasn't rallied since this morning?
No.
All right. Prepare for the operation. We don't want to lose a minute if we can help it.
They're ready in the operating room, Bob.
Nancy, I don't know if I can do it.
Bob!
I can't hold my hands steady. Look at them. All these years I've been hoping, praying that someday I'd be able to help her, and now... No.
Dr. Merrick, this is no time for emotions or sentiment. This is surgery. The fact that the patient is Helen Hudson makes no difference. This is a woman whose life is in your hands, and you can save her. You can and you will. You're not a man right now. You're a surgeon.
Thank you, Nancy. Come on. Lie still, darling. Don't try to move. Yes, dear. It's very important for you to be perfectly quiet.
Oh, Bob. You operated on me.
Yes.
My eyes?
What about your eyes, darling?
I think I can see. Just a little light.
Are you sure?
Yes. Yes, I am sure. What does it mean?
It means that one day, very soon, you will be able to see again.
Oh, Bob.
You must go to sleep now, darling. You mustn't get excited today.
Tomorrow? Can I... Bob, can I get excited tomorrow?
Yes, darling. Tomorrow. Tomorrow is such a beautiful word. Tomorrow our world will begin again. And from now on, it's going to be the same world... for both of us.
In a moment, we'll bring back our star, Cornell Wilde. But first, ladies and gentlemen, may we leave you with this thought.
Shenley Laboratories, makers of penicillin, bring you this program in tribute not only to the famous men of medicine, but also to the one man whose responsibility is your health and welfare, your doctor. Today, your life expectancy is 15 years greater than that of your grandfather, and part of the credit belongs to your doctor. It is the purpose of Shenley Laboratories to aid by every means at our disposal the service rendered you by your physician. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Cornell Wilde.
Words are magnificent instruments for the expression of thoughts and ideas, and simplicity is the soul of clarity. I can think of nothing at this time which better sums up the spirit of this Shenley Laboratories program than this simple prayer. The eternal providence has appointed me to watch over the life and death of all thy creatures. May I always see in the patient a fellow creature in pain. Grant me strength and opportunity, always to extend the domain of my craft. This is the prayer of the physician. It is ages old, yet today it is as new as the hope for a peaceful way of life for all the world. May we invite you to listen again next week at the same time when Shenley Laboratories presents The Life of Louis Pasteur, starring Paul Lucas, a great star in a great vehicle. Good night.
Magnificent Obsession by Lloyd C. Douglas was produced and directed by William Lawrence and is broadcast through the courtesy of Universal Pictures, producers of Night in Paradise. The musical score was by Leith Stevens and the adaptation by Gene Holloway. Cornell Wilde appeared through the courtesy of 20th Century Fox and will soon be seen in their Technicolor production, Centennial Summer.
The Encore Theater, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 4th, 1946 from CBS. And so closes this hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from Radio's Yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVanier. Thanks for tuning in.